Hi, this is Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate on WNYC. A Haitian earthquake, a tsunami in the Indian Ocean, a Chinese earthquake, even the crash of stock markets. What are the biggest events that affect our lives? Disasters. Building up from a disaster takes so much of our resources, yet anticipating disasters is something that hasn't been prioritized. Things are improving, and math just might lead the way. That's what Florin Diaco, who is a professor of mathematics at the University of Victoria in Canada and author of the book Mega Disasters, The Science of Predicting the Next Catastrophe, says. Hello, Professor.
Oh, hi.
And also with us is Rutgers University professor Lee Clark. He's written a number of books on disasters. One has the headline, Mission Improbable, Using Fantasy Documents to Tame Disasters. Thanks for joining us, Professor Clark.
Thanks for having me.
And I'll bite on your title. Fantasy documents? Well, what's the
name? Oh, man, these are plans that promise the world but have very low probability of delivering anything.
So the word duct tape comes up a lot in these plans?
Duct tape turns out to be pretty useful for some things, but these not so much. For example, civil defense plans to empty out Manhattan in case of a nuclear war. Imagine it.
Yeah, these are the versions of duck and cover from the old black and white films in the 50s.
There are other examples, but yes.
Yeah, and so maybe the best thing to do is what Florin Diaco writes about, which is predicting them beforehand. So what, you're a professor of math?
Yes.
And so how does math help in predicting when a tsunami is going to hit?
Well, tsunamis are waves which are described by some differential equations. So trying to understand them, we can model them. But this does not mean necessarily that we can also predict them. And nevertheless, this is a step forward. And normally what we have to predict is generating factor. So, for instance, the earthquakes that generate them. Though tsunamis may not be generated by earthquakes, they can be generated by volcanic eruptions or by landslides or by nuclear experiments done underwater.
Now, some disasters, it seems like it's very hard to predict earthquakes. I mean, they predict them and then say, people say things like in the next decade there'll be a big earthquake. But volcanoes, are they a lot easier to predict?
Volcanoes are of different types, and each type is studied separately. But for volcanoes, we're doing much better than for earthquakes these days. So, for instance, the volcanic eruption that took place near Seattle, Mount St. Helens in 1986, that was pretty well predicted. So like 5 days in advance, volcanologists gave a window of 7 days for it to happen, and 24 hours in advance they said it will happen within 48 hours, which of course it did.
So Professor Clark, if a lot of your work deals with the fact that we have these phony plans that trick ourselves into saying that we have a plan, what about prediction? Is that something that you give much credence to?
I do. In fact, I'm working on two books with my colleague at NYU, Harvey Mollett, right now about how science and scientists can be used to predict disasters. Oh. And Katrina is a great example. You can't predict exactly when a hurricane is going to slam New Orleans, but it's a pretty safe bet that New Orleans is going to get slammed again. So it's a long-term prediction. There are things that you can do. We do. We act. We make public policy on the basis of those kinds of predictions all the time.
Some countries, like the Netherlands, do it. Take it a little more seriously than the United States did in that case.
Well, they take that. They take the flood risk a little more seriously.
Right.
But we've taken earthquake risk very seriously on the West Coast. Where we haven't taken them very seriously is in the Midwest, along the New Madrid Fault, or in Manhattan.
Well, what about I guess it was underreported that this Caribbean fault line seems to be a very active fault line. We haven't heard that much about it.
It wasn't that very active. But some scientists were saying it's only a matter of time. But this is always the problem with disaster. If you can't say it's going to happen on February the 2nd at 2 p.m., there's always going to be forces that support being reactive rather than proactive, because being proactive, being safe about things, always costs money. That's a problem.
Well, what about the economics? I mean, can't you go back and say if an ounce of prevention, an ounce of prevention, a pound of cure. Is there an ounce of prevention example with some of the disasters we're seeing around the world?
There's an ounce of prevention in earthquake preparedness in California, up and down the west coast of the United States. We hopefully have learned some lessons about what happened along the Gulf Coast after Katrina, Rita, and then subsequent hurricanes. Hopefully we're doing something about that. It matters.
Are there places that haven't already been hit where they're being proactive in their preparation?
Oh, There are more places that are being reactive, I'm afraid, than are being proactive.
So, but there is a good example, for instance, that in California, in San Francisco, there's just been announced that scientists in Berkeley are designing real-time warning system, meaning that when an earthquake takes place, or when the plates start moving, there is a small window of opportunity of 10, 15, 20 seconds, up to a minute, when people can be warned the earthquake is coming. So what this means is that there is enough time for at least to duck under the desk, or if you are close to the entrance of the building, to get out of there. And this can be done. It looks like in about 3 years it will be implemented in San Francisco at a cost of only about $80 million.
The Christmas tsunami, what were the warnings there, and were some warnings missed, Professor Diaco?
Well, that could have been very well done, but it wasn't, unfortunately. They didn't have a warning system because the wave started after the earthquake, which took place east of Banda Aceh in Indonesia. And the window of opportunity was about of 2 or 3 hours until it hit the far more coast of the Indian Ocean. So had they had a warning system as we have in North America, most of those 200,000 lives could have been saved.
And you also detail anecdotes in the book where a young girl who was a student in England saw recognized the frothiness of the waves. She remembered she had seen a film about a tsunami in Hawaii in her class back in England, and she warned her mother and father, who then warned the beach and cleared the beach, saved her lives and saved many lives. That's amazing.
Indeed, she was 11 years old at the time, Tilly Smith, and she recognized the danger and saved about 100 lives. That's indeed amazing. So this shows that education and preparedness can indeed help us a lot in such situations.
Well, if there's an 11-year-old who happened to remember a class documentary, I mean, would it be so crazy to think that perhaps lifeguards or people who are looking, or people, you know, manning lighthouses or people looking at the ocean all day could maybe be trained to recognize that?
Certainly. This is one of the points I make in my book, that we have to educate the public to recognize the dangers, because there are always signs, but you just have to recognize them. Nothing comes all of a sudden.
What do you think, Professor Clark?
I think education is a first step, but really meaningful disaster preparation involves involving the public in a very active way, rather than simply telling them, here's what a tsunami looks like. To really prepare people to build kind of the social infrastructure that's necessary for real resilience after the big blow comes is a much more involved effort than just education.
Well, the social infrastructure, we could get to that, but the actual nitty-gritty infrastructure, if you look at the housing stock in Haiti, this is why a 7.0 earthquake in Haiti demolishes the country, and a 7.0 earthquake in San Francisco certainly tore up the Bay Bridge, but 45 people died, not 45,000 or 145,000.
No question it matters. No question it matters. And it's all tied to poverty and the political economy of the place. You know, the lack of building codes or the lack of enforcement of building codes, that happens in a context. That just didn't come out of nowhere.
So do you think it should be United States, it's prudent United States foreign policy to help our poorer neighbors with their disaster preparedness?
How could you say no to that?
Okay, so it's a charged question. Well, what could we do to foster that?
We could try to foster a meaningful, what's euphemistically called, I suppose, a sustainable development that takes into account the needs of the local population, rather than just trying to push people, pursuing policies that push people to concentrate in dangerous places and live under terrible conditions.
Yeah, and are steps being made, Professor Diaco, to foster any of this that we're talking about in some of the places of the world that, if there is a disaster, will have the hardest time building back up?
Well, of course, once a disaster happens, countries all around the world are trying to help. We can just see this example in Haiti now. However, we have to plan for these things because, they do happen, and they do happen all the time. If it's not an earthquake, it's a hurricane or, a financial crash or pandemics, or it can be a volcanic eruption, whatever. I mean, they happen all the time, and we have to be always prepared one way or another. So first of all, as I said, to recognize the danger, as Lee and I agree, and then the next thing is to be prepared to act and to try to minimize the effects of the disaster.
The part of your book, Mega Disasters, The Science of Predicting the Next Catastrophe, that interested me in a way that the other chapters didn't, was talking about the stock market. Just because, yes, of course it would be a great humanitarian thing if we could have predicted the tsunami or the Haitian earthquake and done something to help those people, but it would have been an altruistic endeavor. Whereas with the stock market, people can make millions of dollars if they know the stock market is going to crash, and yet people still don't know the stock market is going to crash. Why is that so hard to see, especially with so much money on the line, Professor Diaku?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that the stock market is a complex system. So complex systems cannot be really modeled through, you know, for instance, differential equations. But we can sometimes understand some features of the stock market. So, for instance, the bubble, the real estate bubble, was clearly predicted by economists and mathematicians. It was obvious that it's going to burst at some point. Nobody knew exactly when. Still, it was not clear to anybody that it would create such a huge crisis, such a huge financial crisis. So people didn't link one with the other. And as they often say, economists, the situation is always different. Well, not necessarily. Many features are the same for all economic crises, and unfortunately, apparently, they look differently. So, as I said, though many people understood that something is going to come, nobody understood the proportions of that. What's going to be in the future? Well, obviously, the way President Obama is going to try to regulate the financial market and the banks is the right way to go, because otherwise we won't learn from the present. We didn't learn from the past too much. Otherwise, you know, greed and the desire to make money is going to get the worst out of us, and a lot of people are going to suffer.
I'm speaking with Florin Diaku, the author of Mega Disasters, The Science of Predicting the Next Catastrophe, published by Princeton University Press, and with disaster expert Lee Clark about how we respond to natural and man-made disasters. We'll have more after a break. Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate on WNYC, speaking with Florin Diaku, professor who has written the book Mega Disasters, The Science of Predicting the Next Catastrophe. Also with me, Rutgers professor Lee Clark. And Mr. Clark's latest book is called Worst Cases, Terror and Catastrophe in the Popular Imagination. Was this very much influenced by 9/11?
It was a good deal influenced by 9/11. I was already working on the book, because the previous book was really about best cases.
Right.
So I was already working on the ideas, and then kind of 9/11 pushed it in a certain way.
Well, one thought that we hear from professors, I always find it an interesting and welcome thought, and you'll probably know his name, the professor at Ohio State, who's also an expert on dance, who's written about probability. I'll remember it if you don't. Probability, and how his thesis is the probability of terrorist attacks is really low, and we're over-prioritizing this probability. What's your take on that? We've heard that.
That's John Mueller.
John Mueller. He is an expert on that.
He's right, of course. But, you know, I would quote my colleague at Stanford, Scott Sagan, who says that things that have never happened before happen all the time. So he's right to say that the probability is low. On the other hand, big events are going to happen. The probability is, here's a great example, very low that there will be a moderate-sized earthquake in Manhattan. But if it does, and it's not impossible, 80% of the buildings in Manhattan are unreinforced masonry.
So, low probability, but maybe we should have built a little bit more to the California code.
Well, it's only been since 1996 that New York City has enforced seismic building codes. Now, we might very well, as a city, as a society, say we want to write that risk off and not pay any attention to it. But to sleepwalk past it is a very different thing than to grapple with the question and reject it.
Tell me about, this is an interesting example that people don't believe when you talk about it. Tell me about the Holland 747 crash.
Oh, good heavens. It's one of those overwhelming events that would, it would be, Professor Mueller would say, it would be crazy to be irrational to plan for. Plane's taken off, Holland 747, it's a monster. One engine falls off, hits another engine, takes that engine off, then the whole thing goes crashing into an apartment complex. People die. It's a cargo plane, so not that many people on the plane. But later we discover there's not only depleted uranium in the tail, which was used for lots of old big planes as a counterweight, but that they were also the major ingredients for sarin gas.
Really?
But it was going to Israel, but they denied it. Ultimately, though, they owned up to it. But it's a confluence of a whole bunch of stuff, all bad things all at once. That you would say, if somebody wrote the scenario ahead of time, man, you're crazy if you're thinking about that, but things that have never happened before happen all the time.
So unprecedented and crazy and improbable, sure, things happen all the time, and what do we do?
Well, plane crashes are a great example. We go and investigate every commercial airplane crash in the United States, and I think that's a great thing to do, and occasionally we learn something that prevents other crashes, but generally not. Right, because lots of contingencies, and most plane crashes are unique. So in a probabilistic sense, you would say it's irrational to go and investigate them. But we do, and it matters for some people. It would matter for a lot if you were on one of those planes.
When you hear people decry government spending, you never hear them talk about let's defund the NTSB because we don't want them to investigate crashes. People think it's a good use of spending. Florian Diaco, I wanted to ask you, since we're talking about the science of predicting the next catastrophe, what's the next likely catastrophe? And maybe you could talk about what's the next very unlikely catastrophe, like Professor Lee Clark was talking about.
Well, obviously, unlikely is to have a collision with an asteroid or a comet. Nevertheless, such a catastrophe would be so bad that it would probably not completely wipe us out from the planet and all life, but at least would send us back to the Stone Age.
Right. And I don't know if there's anything we could do about that, except for those of us who've read Professor Clark's books, we could say, I told you.
No, not really.
I recommend
we
that.
We are now at the stage when we could do something
we
about
could.
It.
We could. What do we do about an asteroid?
Well, for instance, you have to think that these objects are not too large. I mean, they are usually, 500 yards to 3/4 of a mile or a mile in diameter. So what we could do, if we find out, and we can find out these days, if such a near, we call them near-Earth objects, are on a collision course with us, so we can find out, say, 2 or 3 years in advance, then we can send space missions to, for instance, to deviate the trajectory. Because if we do it early enough, then just a small nudge at this point would mean a huge thing in, would translate into hundreds of thousands of miles in a couple of years. So,
and I believe Ben Affleck and Bruce Willis have already made the NASA training film on that.
That's right.
Oh, of course. But let's talk science, not about science fiction.
Yes.
So in this sense, or there is even smaller, we could, for instance, destroy it. There are all kinds of methods, theoretical so far. I've just heard in the news that the Russians are trying to experiment in this sense about an asteroid that is going to come close to Earth in about 2 decades, but I haven't heard the details yet.
Hmm. And so what do you think is the one that the experts are saying, this is going to happen, it's going to happen? I can't tell you the exact time and date, but it's going to happen fairly quickly.
Well, we know, for instance, that earthquakes, so if we talk about New York in particular, well, let me give you a scenario which doesn't look very good. If hurricanes obviously have hit New York in the past, the Hudson River has been swollen in the past, and the tide is, really high once in a while. So if all these three, but never these three things happen at the same time. If they do happen at the same time, then the surge of water in New York could be 7 meters high. So you can imagine that for the authorities, for instance, to decide an evacuation, a mass evacuation of New York, would be a nightmare scenario. What if it the eye of the hurricane is not going to hit. The consequences of an evacuation would be terrible. I mean, there'll be a lot of lives would be lost, obviously, in such a panic, no matter how well you organize it. But what if the hurricane does indeed hit? Maybe a million people die.
Right. So
this is obviously something that is going to happen sooner or later. We don't know when, but it's going to happen in New York. Now, about other...
Well, it won't happen if the asteroid gets us first. We have that to console us.
There are serious people who, astronomers at NASA, who are thinking about this asteroid problem. Comets, nobody's worried about. They're so big, so erratic. If we get one, Bruce Willis is our only hope.
Right. So...
Bye-bye.
And then we could fund the anti-asteroid program with the slogan, don't let the asteroid win. Speaking with Lee Clark, who is a professor at Rutgers, and he has written a number of books. His latest one is called Worst Cases. Florin Diaco's latest book is called Mega Disasters, The Science of Predicting the Next Catastrophe. So let's talk about a catastrophe or a possible catastrophe that was talked about and predicted and didn't come to pass. The latest H1N1 called the swine flu. The outbreak wasn't as bad as some had feared. So that should mean that's a good thing. Fewer people got sick and fewer people died. But health officials say, actually, it might mean the next time when we're even more worried about a serious strain of swine flu, people will take us less seriously. Was there, in your opinion, Professor Clark, a better way for the CDC to have talked about it? Or is it really on people to take it seriously?
It's on us to take it seriously. And I think that to the extent that it was not a big disaster, what did not overwhelm society, it's a testament to the success of public health officials. But we should be clear about this. This is not over. H1N1 is not over. It turns out not to have been as strong as, it's the one that hit us in 1918. That was an H1N1 variant, right?
What's called the Spanish influenza.
Yeah, only because the Spanish, they counted their dead more accurately than others. But there wasn't anything Spanish about it.
Right.
But it was devastating, and lots of people died because of it. It's only in retrospect you can say, well, public officials overreacted. I think that if public officials are trustworthy and they earn our trust, there's not a cry wolf syndrome. Disaster studies show that. If people are believable, if our leaders are believable and establish themselves as credible leaders, not just condescending to people, we'll go get the vaccine. I'll give you a great example if you want it.
Yeah, please.
1949, there's a smallpox outbreak in New York City. And officials, instead of doing what lots of officials do in these kinds of events, which is assume that people are going to freak out if you tell them scary stuff, they announced every new case as it was discovered. They worked through local organizations, faith-based organizations, we would call them today, civic organizations, worked through neighborhood organizations, and they vaccinated 5 million people in 2 weeks. There were 12 cases of smallpox and 2 deaths. There are photos of New Yorkers lined up around the block to get their vaccinations. Why? Why was everything so orderly? Because they trusted their officials.
Well, this was 1949. We had just come through the war. That we had, perhaps been conditioned to buy war bonds and, band together as citizens. That probably helped a little bit, too.
Maybe.
Yeah. And I know, Professor Diaco, you grew up in Romania, and your mom was a biology teacher. So what's your take on pandemics?
Well, this is indeed a serious problem. And as you know, in the Spanish flu after the war killed more people than the war. There were about 50 million deaths, as we estimate today. The trick is that, for instance, with H1N1, we did the right thing. I mean, both in the United States and Canada, we vaccinated a lot of people, so only who didn't want to get the vaccine didn't get it. And these are the consequences that, though it's not over, as Lee said, we somehow tamed it. And the goal of a prediction is not to say after that, well, I told you so. The goal is to make things better for everybody. So the fact that the media took action and at the same time the World Health Organization took action and our countries as well. So it showed, and that's the right thing to do. Now, there are all kinds of research done these days trying to predict the genetic mutation through mathematical models, so the genetic mutation of the viruses, because as you know, these viruses that come from birds or from pigs, first they may get transmitted to people, but not necessarily, they don't get necessarily transmitted from person to person. But if they mutate, they do, as it happened with H1N1. And then the goal we all have is to make a prediction to see that it's coming and to prevent it.
Now, you, Lee Clark, you mentioned that there is no cry wolf syndrome. People, because, you know, I've covered some hurricanes in the South, and I know Florida's got it down pretty good, and the people know to take it seriously, but I did cover Hurricane Rita in Texas. This was the big hurricane that came soon after Katrina, and it was predicted to be a very bad hurricane, and people fled Houston. And it turns out more people died in the evacuation than died because of the hurricane, which pretty much missed Houston. And now officials there are worried. Obviously, they have to get their contraflow, which is when they change the lane directions better. But they're worried that next time that people will ignore them, and they shouldn't.
Well, they need to make sure that they have good plans in place to evacuate people. It's not that people sit there and say, well, I don't believe some do say the hurricane's not going to come here, and so I will stay here and ride it out. There are always those riders. I don't understand it, but, you know, whatever. But if lots of people stay, it's because they've made the calculation that they're going to be stuck on I-10 for 8 hours, and that they have a chance of, you know, if they're on medication or what, they're safer sticking where they are than they are evacuating. That's a problem.
Right.
That's a problem.
So the answer, the problem isn't that they cried wolf. The problem is that they had a lousy evacuation in the first place.
And so that led them to a completely different calculation the second time.
Right. So the final question, and David Brooks wrote about this, maybe the best disaster preparedness is just to build up poor countries' economies so that they could deal with a disaster better in the first place. Go ahead.
It's a very rough, that's a very rough prescription, and it works. But let's look quickly at the case of Cuba. When a hurricane comes screaming through Cuba, people, hundreds of thousands of people die in Haiti or Jamaica. Nobody or very few die in Cuba. They're poor, but they're prepared. It's possible. Money doesn't solve everything, but it solves a lot of things.
What do you think, Professor Diaco, quickly?
Well, I definitely agree. So, for instance, as I said about the risk of a cosmic impact, it's small, but if it comes, we'll get back to the Stone Age. So it's important to allocate money for this kind of research, for instance.
That sort of threat concentrates the mind. I want to thank you very much. Florin Diaco is a professor in Canada at the University of Victoria. Yes, he's the author of Mega Disasters, The Science of Predicting the Next Catastrophe. And Lee Clark has written a few books on disasters. The latest is Worst Cases, Terror and Catastrophe in the Popular Imagination. Thank you both.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you very much.